This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in your podcast app.
I would like to start by thanking the Stein Institute for Research in Aging for inviting me to share my research with the community. I'm very happy to be here today to talk about how physical activity can help to improve our brain. And also, I look forward to answering your questions and hopefully engaging in discussion after we finish with the presentation. So first, I'm going to cover some background about how being physically active can help preserve cognitive function and brain health and potentially reduce the risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. We will also review the current physical activity recommendations for older adults, followed by a summary of the research that my lab has been conducting over the past 7 years on how physical activity can affect brain health and how digital devices can facilitate older adults meeting the recommendations for physical activity. I will then summarize the information and open it up for discussion, for questions. So first, let's review some background. We are all familiar probably with the term the silver tsunami, which refers to the rapidly growing aging population that our world is currently experiencing. So the world is aging, and this exponential growth is accompanied by greater prevalence of chronic conditions that typically happen with aging, which can take a toll on, you know, the person themselves and their families and also the healthcare system. Some of these things include, for example, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, hearing and other sensory changes that happen with aging. Physical inactivity also happens a lot as we age, and also dementia. But some of the chronic conditions that are associated with aging are also known risk factors for the development of Alzheimer's disease. For example, just as I just showed in the earlier slide, you know, not having enough physical activity, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, diabetes, depression, and hearing loss are also risk factors for developing Alzheimer's disease. So just really quick, I wanted to just review what is dementia. So dementia is a syndrome in which a person experiences changes in their cognitive function. So for example, they may have problems with memory, or difficulty communicating like they used to. And this is beyond what is expected for normal biological aging. And these cognitive changes interfere with the person's ability to remain independent in their everyday life. So they may not be able to manage their medication or their appointments, or they may be unable to drive like they used to. And this affects not only the person, but also their families, as well as the healthcare system. And so dementia is an umbrella term that describes various different conditions, and Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia, which is the most common, accounting for about 60 to 80% of dementia cases. So there are more than 6 million people in the United States who are living with Alzheimer's, and it is projected that by the year 2050, this number is going to rise to approximately 13 million. So because treatments and cures have not been successful, there has to be now an emphasis on trying to prevent dementia before the symptoms even start. And fortunately, there is hope when it comes to reducing our risk of developing dementia. A recent report suggested that up to 40% of dementia could be attributable to a combination of modifiable risk factors, such as education, hypertension in midlife, midlife obesity, hearing loss, depression, diabetes, physical inactivity, smoking, and social isolation. So through minimizing some of these risk factors that, you know, thankfully can be changed, it is thought that they help to reduce the neuropathological damage that happens that leads to dementia. And so, for example, maintaining a frequent program of exercise can help to reduce damage to the brain and potentially help to help the brain so that it doesn't develop some of the pathologies that can be associated with Alzheimer's disease, such as amyloid beta plaques and tau in the brain. And it may also affect other vascular or inflammatory pathways that can lead to dementia prevention. But also, some of these modifiable lifestyle factors can help to help the brain be more resilient to the things that happen with aging and disease. And that's what some people call cognitive reserve. So, for example, helping with hearing impairment, being social frequently, and having higher levels of education may help our brain to just be more resilient to these changes. So now I will focus specifically on physical activity and how it can help to maintain brain health and cognition in aging. So there are large studies that have shown that higher physical activity, which I'm depicting here with the letters P and A, so physical activity, is related to 14% lower dementia risk compared to people who do lower levels of physical activity. Another study showed that compared to people who are sedentary, even low to moderate levels of physical activity have been associated with 35% reduction of risk for cognitive decline over time. A more recent report from colleagues here at UC San Diego showed that among older women, moderate to vigorous levels of physical activity, or MVPA, were associated with lower risk of developing mild cognitive impairment and dementia risk. And this was just by doing 31 minutes of moderate levels of physical activity per day, or 1,865 steps per day. So how does physical activity help the brain? So aging is associated with an adverse cardiovascular profile that includes increases in blood pressure, the arteries become stiffer, and also there's endothelial dysfunction. So those things typically happen with aging. And it is thought that aerobic exercise can help by attenuating this vascular aging and might either directly or indirectly be associated with preserved cerebrovascular function that can lead to less pathology in the brain, leading to better cognition. This is just one of the theories of how physical activity affects the brain, but there may be many, many different pathways. More specifically, one of the mechanisms by which exercise can lead to cognitive improvements is through changes in cerebral blood flow, or the amount of blood that flows to the brain. The brain needs a lot of blood to be able to perform all of the millions of activities that it performs. And so we need to get that blood in the brain so that it gives us the nutrients that we need to be able to perform. And it's thought that physical exercise can improve cerebrovascular function through changes in cerebral blood flow that can then affect cognitive performance. And it's also important to look at cerebral blood flow because it has also been considered as an early risk marker of Alzheimer's disease, because cerebral blood flow does change throughout the lifespan, and it changes also when people are at risk for Alzheimer's disease, and it also changes when people are, you know, in Alzheimer's disease. So it really reduces once people reach Alzheimer's disease, the clinical manifestations. So before moving on to my research on cerebral blood flow and physical activity, I wanted to take a moment to review the current physical activity recommendations for older adults. So the Department of Health and Human Services recommends that older adults perform at least 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity aerobic activity, and also at least 2 days per week of muscle strengthening activity. If the activity is more vigorous, then they recommend at least 75 minutes per week. But lately, there has been more of a push to try to get closer to 300 minutes a week of moderate intensity physical activity. So how do we know what moderate physical activity is? Some people can use the TOG test to find out if they're maybe exercising or being active at a moderate level. So for example, if you're breathing hard, but you can still have a conversation easily, you may be in moderate intensity physical activity. But if you can only say a few words before you have to take a breath, then that may be more vigorous activity. And what kinds of activities count? It could be anything. It could be things that you do anyway around the house. As long as you get your heart rate up a little bit, you know, that really should be helpful for your health. It could be things like gardening, vacuuming more vigorously, dancing, you know, walking, playing with your grandchildren, etc. And they really recommend now an approach of just moving more, sitting less, and doing activity, you know, even if you don't have half an hour in a day to go for a walk, you can do 10 minutes, you can do 5 minutes here and there. It really matters that you move throughout the day instead of sitting throughout the day. So now let's go back to the association of cerebral blood flow with physical activity. And let's review some of the research that we've been doing in my lab for some time. So some time ago, I really wanted to explore the associations of physical activity that would be measured objectively rather than self-recorded with questionnaires, and to see how it associated with cerebral blood flow, because there wasn't much research at the time looking at how physical activity performed in everyday life, in everyday environments, could affect the brain. Most of the studies had been done in lab environments where people are under supervision or they follow a strict regimen and someone is making sure that they're doing certain kinds of exercise and then they measure the changes to the brain. I wanted to know if these kinds of things actually generalize to the real world and if we could measure associations between physical activity and the brain when people are just being active or living their lives, everyday lives. So for this study, we measured, we used these devices called accelerometers. It's kind of like a Fitbit or any kind of device that measures your movement and how much you move and the intensity of the movement. These are just research-grade accelerometers that people wear on the waist, and they wear them for 1 week at home. And we don't ask them to change anything about their life, just go about their lives while we measure their activity. For this study, we had 52 cognitively healthy older adults. We collaborated with a colleague, Dr. Cristina Werenga here at UC San Diego. And the individuals were between the ages of 65 and 85. The mean age was 72. 58% of them were women. The education on average was about 16 years. And most of these participants didn't have any history of vascular disease. We got also a brain MRI where we were able to measure their cerebral blood flow. So this is a map of how what we get from these images basically tell us where there's more and less blood flow in each little region of the brain. So what we found with this study is that more minutes spent in MBPA or moderate levels of physical activity in everyday environments were correlated with more cerebral blood flow in the frontal lobe of the participants. And the frontal lobe is one of the areas that as we age starts to shrink and decline first. So what we see is that this physical activity that people are performing at home seems to be beneficial for getting more blood flow to a region that is important for aging, that is affected by aging. We also looked at the association with different intensities of physical activity, and we saw that even lighter physical activities, not just the moderate ones, were associated with greater blood flow in the frontal lobe. And so was something that we call total activity counts, which is another measure we get from the accelerometer that shows us basically just overall volume of activity, more frequent, more intense activity. So just higher numbers mean more and more frequent and more intense activity. And that was also associated with more or higher cerebral blood flow in the frontal lobe of older adults. These were all older adults who were cognitively healthy. They didn't have any cognitive impairment. But interestingly, when we looked at the sedentary time, or the time that the device calculates that people are not moving around, no expending energy, so sitting or laying down, was actually associated negatively with cerebral blood flow. So, you know, the more time people were spending in the sedentary, being sedentary, was associated with lower cerebral blood flow in the frontal lobe. So what we learned from this study was that everyday physical activity is associated with cerebral blood flow in brain regions that are affected by the aging process. And greater physical activity of all intensities seems to be beneficial to cerebral blood flow, while sedentary time was detrimental to cerebral blood flow in this study. Another small study that we did in collaboration with Dr. Christina Waringa here at UCSD found that greater sedentary time, or this time spent sitting and not expending energy, was associated with greater tau protein buildup in the cerebrospinal fluid of older adults who are cognitively healthy. This tau is a hallmark pathology for neurodegeneration, and is typically seen in Alzheimer's disease. And so this is, again, these are people who are not having any cognitive impairment, but there seems to be this association of, you know, the more sedentary we are, the more we show these proteins that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. So sedentary time may be a behavioral risk factor for the development of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. In a different study, we looked at how different kinds of sedentary activities may be related to cognitive function in healthy older adults. So we studied 62 cognitively healthy older adults. They were about 72 years old. 68% of them were women, with a mean education of about 16 years. And we gave them questionnaires and asked them about the different kinds of activities that they do on a typical week or weekend while they are sitting. Because not all sitting behavior may be bad for the brain. So we really wanted to learn more about what kinds of sitting behaviors may be beneficial versus which ones may not. And so what we did is then grouped the activities into what we called active sedentary behaviors and passive sedentary behaviors. So the active ones were things that would engage your brain. Even though you're sitting, you're engaging your brain. So things like using the computer, reading, socializing, driving, you know, doing hobbies, or, you know, volunteering or being at the office working. Whereas the passive sedentary behaviors were more things like watching TV, eating, or taking a nap. And what we wanted to see is how these active versus passive sedentary behaviors were associated with actual cognitive function that we measured in person. So what we found is that not all sedentary behaviors seem to be detrimental to cognitive function. So the time spent in active sedentary behaviors, so that was the reading, hobbies, using the computer, was not associated with memory or with executive function scores. Executive functions are cognitive abilities that allow us to multitask, to make decisions. They're higher level cognitive functions that really is what makes us human in terms of our cognitive abilities. But we did see that the passive sedentary behaviors, like watching TV, was negatively associated with executive function scores. So the more people reported spending watching TV, the lower their scores were on tests of executive functioning. So it doesn't seem that all sedentary time is equal. That's what our preliminary data suggest. But now we are doing more research and collecting more data to learn more about how different kinds of sitting behaviors may affect not only cognitive function, but also the brain, so that when we develop interventions to help people be more active and sit less, we can also give them some guidance on what kinds of sitting behaviors may be worse than others. In a different study that we recently published with Dr. Catherine Bangan here at UC San Diego, we studied if moderate levels of physical activity or lighter types of physical activity, light intensity physical activities, were associated with memory function and executive functions in 43 older adults who were overall very healthy and they didn't have any cognitive impairment. Again, the age was about 72 years and 74% were women. They did a one-week accelerometer measurement period so that we could look at their physical activity levels at different intensities. And we also gathered brain MRIs to look at cerebral blood flow and to look at also what we call white matter hyperintensities, which are reflective of small vessel cerebrovascular disease and have been also associated with increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. What we found is that greater time spent in MBPA or moderate levels of activity were associated with better performance in memory tests and better performance on tests of executive functioning. And again, this is measuring with accelerometer people's physical activity in their everyday life without asking them to change anything about their behavior. We also found that greater time spent in moderate levels of activity was associated with a lower white matter hyperintensity volume. So like I said before, these tiny white matter hyperintensities are reflective of small cerebrovascular disease. And so it's good to have less. And basically what we're seeing is that that moderate levels of physical activity seem to be related to lower white matter hyperintensity volume. And this was not the case for the lighter activities. They were not associated with the white matter hyperintensity load. We also found, interestingly, that moderate levels of physical activity in this study were not associated with cerebral blood flow, but lighter activities were. So not so moderate, but lighter physical activities were actually associated with more cerebral blood flow in some areas of the frontal lobes and the temporal lobes, which are also areas that tend to be affected by the aging process. So our findings suggest that physical activity may be beneficial for cerebrovascular health, and this is both with the white matter hyperintensities and cerebral blood flow. And they also suggest that lighter intensity physical activity may be more sensitive to subtle changes in the cerebrovascular function, for example, the cerebral blood flow, whereas moderate levels of physical activity may be more favorable in protecting against cognitive decline, or they may be more beneficial for cognition and may be necessary to help the development of frank lesions, which are these white matter hyperintensities. So the alterations in cerebral blood flow may represent a more early or subtle change in cerebrovascular function that precedes the development of these frank lesions that we term, we know as white matter hyperintensities. So now I'd like to move from observational studies where we just take a snapshot of people at one point in time and correlate things and associate to see how they relate to each other, to an interventional approach where we actually ask people to change their physical activity levels and then monitor them over time and see how cognition and the brain change as a function of actually changing the behavior. And I really wanted to learn if mobile health devices for digital health devices, you know, like smartwatches and things that can track your heart rate, could help older adults increase MBPA or moderate intensity activity in their everyday environments independently, so that they could do these things at home without having to go to the gym or, you know, go to participate in a study and go to the lab to perform the activities. So we conducted a small study called the Independent Walking for Brain Health Study that was funded by the NIH. And it was a small randomized controlled trial of exercise where we used mobile health device to help older adults increase their moderate activity in their free living everyday environments. And the device that we gave them tracked heart rate in real time, and it provided them with immediate feedback while they were out on a walk or doing an activity if they deviated from a prescribed heart rate target that we prescribed to them based on moderate activity for that person. And so in this way, the device acted as a coach for behavior change and to help them adjust their walking pace, you know, walk a little faster if they were, you know, if the heart rate was too low. So it was more of a coach from a distance that could help them change their behavior in real time. So we had a control group, and the control group received a reading prescription. So they read about healthy aging topics, and then they received weekly quizzes about those materials. And then they also had received some monitoring phone calls from the study staff. And the exercise, people who were in the exercise condition received an individualized walking prescription with a target heart rate that was individual to them based on a treadmill test that they did with us. They received a device that measured their heart rate and provided the immediate feedback about their heart rate while they were exercising or, you know, being physically active independently. They received their regular phone calls from the study staff, and they also got a weekly progress email where we show them a graph of their progress of how many minutes they were spending above their minimum heart rate target that was equivalent to moderate activity. So that was shared with them every week so they could see their progress. And so we had 22 participants that were randomized to the control condition, 21 participants to the exercise condition, and the mean age was 72 years, and about 74% of the sample were women. We did some genetic testing for dementia risk. We did a fitness test, which was a submaximal fitness test where people walked fast on a treadmill while we were changing the incline to see so that we could determine what their heart rate equivalent to moderate intensity activity was for that person, so we could do an individualized prescription. We measured physical activity with accelerometers, which are these devices that we've been using to measure activity in the real world. And we did cognitive testing, and we also did a brain MRI before and after the intervention. The intervention lasted 3 months. So this was the device that we used in the intervention. At the time that we started this, it was the least expensive device that was able to provide feedback to the person in real time about their heart rate. So we were able to, for each person, determine their heart rate target range for moderate intensity activity. And then we programmed that into the app on the phone, so that, you know, the green zone would be their target, and then anything below would light up the device with a blue light, and then everything above would be a red light. And the device also vibrated when the participants were outside of their target heart rate zone. So this, we thought, would help them to adjust their behavior and, you know, walk faster so that they could get there as many minutes as possible in the moderate intensity physical activity. So 17 out of the 21 completed the exercise condition, and then 19 of the 22 completed the control. 15 out of the 17 who were in the exercise condition actually increased the time that they spent in moderate levels of physical activity over that three-month period. And data from the device itself showed that after 12 weeks, the participants increased the time that they spent in moderate levels of physical activity by 95%. So it was a great increase. This is an average of 138 minutes per week. So the device really helped them to change their exercise intensity in real time to spend more minutes in moderate levels of physical activity. And when we asked the participants after they finished the intervention if wearing the device helped them to, you know, walk faster or exercise harder, 100% of them said that that was the case, that they thought the device really helped them. So that increase in moderate activity that we saw over time was also corroborated by research grade accelerometers, where we measured at three different time points: before the intervention, in the middle, and then at the end of the intervention. And we actually saw that by the end of the intervention, the exercise group had 19 more minutes on average per day of moderate intensity physical activity compared to the control group. So that was a great outcome. The device really seemed to help them stay on track with their goal and to be able to change their behavior in real time without having to have a coach there with them or, you know, without supervision. And although we don't have a large enough sample to look at how changes in cerebral blood flow and cognition happened over time between the groups, I just wanted to explore how changes in the cerebral blood flow and changes in cognition were related to changes in daily levels of moderate activity. And this graph is just showing the changes in that for those people who increased their physical activity over time, there was a very variable response in the blood flow of the brain. So we had some people who increased it and some people who decreased it. And this isn't really that surprising because cerebral blood flow is very dynamic. It changes with age. It changes over time. It changes depending on how much a person, the risk for Alzheimer's disease that a person may have. So it makes sense that with a small sample and a short intervention period, we wouldn't see a very consistent response. But this is something that we are really interested in continuing to explore over time. We saw that for people who increased their moderate activity, that was associated with increased total gray matter. So the structure of the brain increased over that period for those who increased their physical activity levels. And again, these are not like statistically significant results. This is just to show that there seems to be a positive association of changing your activity with better executive performance and also better memory performance over time with an intervention such as this. So now what we plan to do is larger intervention that lasts at least 6 months to see if we can have findings like this and better understand how blood flow changes before and after a person is able to increase their physical activity, especially the moderate levels of physical activity over time. So in summary, we can say from these studies that everyday physical activity can influence the brain and cognitive health, that moderate levels of physical activity and also lighter activities seem to be helpful for cerebral blood flow in areas that are typically affected by aging, such as the frontal lobe and the temporal lobes, and that this effect seems to vary and be specific to different areas of the brain. We also know that MBPA, or moderate activity, may be necessary to influence cognition and small vessel cerebrovascular disease, or frank lesions that we see in the brain. We also have learned that mHealth can act as a coach to help older adults increase moderate physical activity in their free living environments. And we just need to do more interventions with a larger groups of people to confirm our findings. But we also need to learn more about how sedentary time, or just that time that we spend sitting, impacts the brain and our cognition. So with that, I would like to thank all the students and the staff in my lab, all the many collaborators that have helped us along the way with these studies, and our funding sources, especially the National Institute on Aging that funded this study and the intervention study. So with that, I will open it for questions, and feel free to email me if there are any questions that I can't answer today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Slatdar, for such a great talk. I loved it. You have some great questions. So shall we just go ahead and get started?
Sure.
Okay. First question. Do we know exactly how much physical activity is needed to promote brain health?
I wish we knew. That's what we're trying to learn. There's not a magic number still. You know, the recommendations that we have are mostly for overall health and cardiovascular health, but there is no magic number that is recommended for brain health. And that's really what we are trying to do and understand, not only the number, like how many minutes a week or hours a week, but also what is the best type of exercise? Does it need to be intense? Does it need to be moderate? Can lighter activities also help, and how they can interact with each other? So I hope that we can get there someday soon.
Okay, great. This next question, I want to know the answer to. So do you have to be active your entire life to see cognitive benefits of being physically active?
So there have been some studies that show that no, that you can still benefit even if you start exercising when you are 65, 70 years old, that you can still see benefits to your cognition and your brain, even if you start late. So it's never too late. That's really the message. It's never too late. And doing something is better than nothing. So even if you don't have a lot of time, get up for 10 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is, it should help.
Okay, great. So that ties into this next question that we have. Is being sedentary bad for the brain? What if I don't exercise, but I stand up and move around a lot?
Yeah, so that's why I was showing some of this interesting research about sedentary time, because not all sitting time may be bad, because if you're engaging your brain in a way, maybe that offsets some of the bad part of being sedentary. But we just don't know yet. I think the sedentary research field is it's newer, so we're still learning a lot. But we now everyone recommends that you move around more, so it's better to stand than to sit, for example. And we really want to learn what kinds of sedentary behaviors may be worse than others, and how much you can offset being sedentary by being active. So let's say if you have a desk job and you have to be at your desk for 8 hours a day, well, how much do I need to be active to offset that, right? And also, by what if I was really cognitively engaged during those 8 hours that I was in my computer? We still don't have the answers. And that's a really exciting area of research that we are pursuing.
Okay, great. Okay. So you mentioned preventing head injury for dementia reduction. But what if a person already sustained several traumatic brain injuries? Are there any recommendations that could reduce their risk?
So I think that in general, being, you know, healthy and leading a healthy lifestyle can help your brain to build that resilience in your brain and that reserve. So in general, being physically active and eating a healthy diet and, you know, keeping your mind working should help, even if your brain has already sustained some trauma. It should help to give it as much boost as possible to keep it resilient.
Okay, that's great to hear. Here's a great question. Was your research conducted before, during, or after COVID lockdown? What impact do you think the last 3 years of prolonged social isolation has had on older adults?
Yeah, I think so. Some of the studies, the observational studies that I described at the beginning of just associating the brain with physical activity, were conducted pre-COVID. The intervention study was actually had to be terminated early because of COVID. So we couldn't get the entire sample of people that we wanted because we couldn't bring them in to get their MRIs or anything. So that was affected. So we were supposed to have a larger group of people participate. But I'm grateful that we still have some interesting data from that. But more anecdotally about the effects of isolation, I've seen them more in clinic when I see patients that, you know, they have memory problems and they come to see us and we can help to evaluate their cognition. I did see just anecdotally that social isolation really, really affected a lot of the people we see, in that it seemed to just trigger cognitive problems or make them worse when they were so isolated.
Yeah, unfortunately. Isolation, yeah. It's really bad on our overall health, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, here's another one. Are you accepting new participants in your research study? What ages could participate?
So right now, that study is closed, and we're going to begin a new study that is going to be only with Hispanic older adults. And when we have that ready to go, we will definitely advertise it. So unfortunately, we're not recruiting right now, but stay tuned because I'm sure, you know, Danielle can send out information later on to listservs and anything as new studies come along.
That's great. Okay, that's fantastic. In your research studies, did you account for race and other diversity factors in addition to gender and age? Can you comment on the influence of genetics, race, culture, etc. in your findings?
So that's a big area that I do in my research. With this study, it's such a small study. It was just 43 people, and 93% of them were, you know, Caucasian, white, you know, about 7% were Hispanic. And that is a big problem in all of the research that we do, because people from more diverse background don't tend to volunteer for these studies. And so we are doing many, many things to try to change that, especially I am Hispanic myself. And so to me, it's really important to make sure that Hispanics are, you know, included in research. So like I said, now I have a new project in partnership with Kaiser Permanente, where we're actually developing a new intervention just for older Hispanic adults. And they're going to help us to actually design the intervention and then give us feedback so that it's really culturally appropriate for them. In terms of dementia, though, there are differences, very significant differences in how people from Latino background, you know, are at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And we don't quite know why. So that is another area of research that I'm also pursuing. It's trying to better understand how these cultural factors affect our cognition and our risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. It's a very important research to do.
Absolutely. I agree. Is interval training especially good for people? What are your thoughts around interval training?
So I think there is not much research on interval training for older adults for cognition. So I think there is some research, right? But they may be looking at other outcomes. So, you know, vascular health or in terms of cognition, there isn't much out there. So I don't think I can say anything about that yet. But I know that research in that area is underway.
Okay, so stay tuned. Okay. What kind of heart monitor did you use? And do you recommend that everybody use one or try one?
So we used a device that is no longer even being sold. It was called Mio Fuse. And like I said, I selected it because at the time we started the study, which was back in 2016, the device was the only one that actually gave us this vibration and different color lights in real time when we were exercising. And you didn't have to have your phone on you. You just had the device, which is like a watch. You go on your walk and it tells you when you're not in your zone that you want to be. I always have used the device. I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in that, but I don't think you need that to be healthy. But if you are someone who really enjoys watching your progress with real numbers and like seeing graphs of how much you're doing, I think they are great devices, and they, you know, they're getting more and more accurate at tracking heart rate. They're not perfect, but they are getting more and more accurate.
Okay, great. Did you say that increased physical activity increases gray matter in the brain, and what proportion?
So these are, you know, these are small effects. So it's nothing, you know, crazy. But yes. So the brain shrinks as we age. And so it's really nice to see that, you know, when we become more physically active, maybe some of that, you know, reverses, or it may just help to maintain it so that you don't lose your gray matter over time if you're physically active. So it, like I described before, it could help us, our brain, to be more resilient so that those changes that typically happen with aging, like your brain shrinking, you know, may either not happen for a longer time so that you maintain your brain bigger and functioning and better connected and better communicating with each other. So that's what we think that is doing with the actual gray matter of the brain, the structure of the brain.
Okay, great. Did your study also look at or collect sleep data, and it wasn't reported here, or do you have thoughts about including sleep in your future studies?
We did not include sleep in the study because that device was very clunky and big. So it's not something I would have wanted people or asked them to wear to sleep. But that's definitely something that we are interested for the future, now that devices are, you know, much comfortable and people usually wear them to sleep anyway. It's definitely an area that is very interesting.
Okay, great. How old will your participants need to be for your new 6-month program? I participated previously and now I am 75 and still active.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So for when we are applying for funding for a larger study, so we don't have it going on yet, but usually all the studies that we do are, you know, between 65 years old and 85 years old. So if you're in your 70s, you should be fine.
Okay, great. I've never used devices. Do they differentiate between physical activity and movement through driving? I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I think maybe the question is asking whether if you're wearing an accelerometer or a Fitbit or something, if they can tell whether you're moving because you're in a car driving. And the answer is yes. They may not be perfect at it, but they're supposed to be able to pick up on the fact that it's not movement of the body activity, and it should be removing that when they use their algorithms for, you know, adjusting for that. Also, when we ask the participants to wear the accelerometers, we ask them also to not wear them while they sleep. So all of the movement would be movement that is not sleep associated.
Okay, great. So we have two questions that I think sort of tag team on each other. One of them is, can you spell the name of the heart rate device you used? And the other one is, name the tracking device you used and where people can get one. I love that people want to use devices. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good. So it's called Mio, M-I-O, Fuse, F-U-S-E. But like I said, I don't think they're in production anymore. So I don't know that you would be able to find one. That said, I think any device that can measure your heart rate, like a Fitbit or, you know, Apple Watch or, you know, smartwatches that they look at you can look at your heart rate. You can learn what type of heart rate you have when you're working at a moderate intensity, where you may be able to, you know, hold a conversation with someone if you're walking, but you can't sing, you know, and your heart is pumping. You may look at your watch and say, oh, you know, I'm at around 110. This seems like a good heart rate for me for moderate. And you could track it like that. So I don't necessarily espouse any device in particular. So it's mostly just for you to learn about yourself or learn about your heart rate and about your body.
Okay, great. So here's a really interesting question. Does sitting here and watching and thinking about this program today have a beneficial, neutral, or detrimental effect on my brain health today?
Well, hopefully it's a beneficial one, because if you were thinking and engaged, right, maybe that offsets your sitting. But as you can see, I'm standing. I have a standing desk. So when I work and because otherwise I would be sitting all day. So I try to stand, and that's something everyone can do. So if you're watching TV, making a phone call, instead of sitting, you can stand. And, you know, maybe that's better. I hope that we can have more data for you on that in the next few years.
That's great. Do you find a standing desk beneficial?
I do. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So we have time for one more question, Dr. Slatar. Does 30 minutes of yoga daily affect brain health?
So there have been many studies about how yoga or meditation, mindfulness is beneficial to the brain. So just the mechanisms of how it may affect it may be different, but it does seem to be beneficial. Any activity that, you know, keeps your mind healthy, keeps your body healthy, your vascular system healthy is going to be good for the brain.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Slatar, for coming here today and teaching us everything you know about physical activity and brain health. Our participants loved it. I loved it. We're so grateful for your time today. I want to thank all of you for joining another one of our public lectures. We loved having you here. If you want to learn more about us or support our work, you can go to aging.ucsd.edu, and we will see you all in a few months for our next public lecture. Thanks for coming tonight. Thank you, Dr. Slatar.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.